Hello, welcome to the Positive Energy Podcast. I'm your host, Ian T.D. Thompson. The Positive Energy Podcast is the official podcast of the University of Ottawa's Positive Energy Initiative. The initiative seeks to strengthen public confidence in Canadian energy policy, regulation, and decision-making through evidence-based research and analysis, engagement, and recommendations for action. Today on the program, we will be listening to Nick Nanos' keynote address from Positive Energy's October 7th conference. Entitled Divided, Polarization, and Canada's Energy Future in an Age of Climate Change, the conference convenes senior leaders from business, government, Indigenous communities, civil society, and the academy to examine and address polarization in Canadian politics, in particular, its effects on energy decision-making. At the conference, Positive Energy released original public opinion research on polarization, along with cutting-edge research on drivers of polarization and recommendations to address it. Nick Nanos is the chair and CEO of Nanos Research, as well as chair of the University of Ottawa's Positive Energy Initiative. In his keynote, Nick Nanos showcased new survey research. This survey research examined public opinion as well as energy expert opinion on Canada's energy and climate policies. This survey work is now available on Positive Energy's website. Additionally, video of the keynote, as well as of other conference discussions, are available on ISSP U Ottawa's YouTube channel, which is linked in the description. I hope you enjoy.
As you might imagine, working with the Positive Energy team and Monica has been fantastic, just because of not just the importance of the work, but actually the quality of the team and all of the outputs. I think the Positive Energy Initiative is putting a very important spotlight on what I'll say. I'd say it's the most important public policy issue that we're dealing with. You know, what's interesting is that, you know, when in our regular tracking, we ask Canadians every week what the top unprompted national issue of concern is, where people can say whatever they want. And it's within the last 6 months or thereabouts that the environment has actually surpassed jobs and healthcare. For 30 years of polling, jobs and healthcare have always been number one or number two, depending on the public policy environment. In the last 6 months, the environment has actually surpassed jobs and healthcare. And many times I'm asked why. And I actually say, based on the research that we've done, is that now when people think of the environment, it is more than just global warming and climate change. Now, and I think this is the good news for Positive Energy and the work that Monica and her team are doing, when people hear the word or the issue of the environment, they're thinking about jobs, they're thinking about resource development, they're thinking about pipelines, they're thinking about carbon tax, they're also still thinking about climate change and global warming, but it's actually a much more complex picture. So if there's one idea for me to leave with you, a high-level idea regarding the work that Positive Energy has done, is that we are at a particular moment in time, a moment in time where the right project is happening in the right place with the right people, and people are much more interested in this. And we're not just talking about stakeholders, but I would hazard to say that average Canadians are more likely to think of the environment as something as more than a tick as to whether we're moving in the right or wrong direction when it comes to climate change, and can understand the interconnectivity that the environment has on our vision for the country, the types of jobs that we're going to have for the future, the structure of our economy, and our fundamental aspirations as we try to reconcile the environment and the economy. That said, it's a tough job, right? There are no easy solutions. And I guess, you know, one way to kind of summarize everything is people know that we can do a better job. We're not doing a good job, and they want action. And I think the other thing is that people are looking to have a more complex discussion. And my last aside, before I get into the two studies that we're going to give you a high-level background on, is that this election has been a fundamental disappointment, because it has been characterized by personal bickering between the two party leaders. And think of it this way. For people that are worried about the future, worried about whether their sons or daughters will have jobs, wonder about climate change and all those other issues, that it is basically a political desert. They're willing to drink a dirty glass of water. Could someone deliver a dirty glass of water tonight and to say, you know what, this election is not about abortion. It is not about the accreditation of a leader. It is not about a picture that was taken 19 years ago. It's not about any of those things. All those things are the past. Will someone please talk about the future? And I think that's why any contribution that Positive Energy can make to being focused on the future and putting a realistic spotlight on what is polarizing and what is potentially a consensus opinion is actually critical. So let's, I'm hopeful and not hopeful. Because the reality is, if we don't see a shift to anyone talking about anything substantive tonight, there's only 2 weeks left in the election. The reality is, if there's bickering tonight and there's bickering on Thursday in the French leaders' debate, this will basically probably sum up this election campaign, and I think it's a significantly missed opportunity, especially when we kind of unpack some of the numbers that we have and also the numbers that Stephen and Eric have. It just speaks to the certain level of urgency and I would hazard to say potential disappointment. So that's the end of my rant. Next, in terms of what I'm going to present, I'm going to present two pieces of research. One is what we would call the GenPop survey, which would be the general population. It was completed just before Labor Day. And then the other piece of research is the elite opinion based on the panel that Monica had told you about. And similar to Steve and Eric, last night we were working on our summaries of the elite opinion because we closed that out on Friday. But we wanted to make sure that we brought that to the table, even in a preliminary sense, in order to start a discussion. And actually, on that point of starting a discussion, and actually Monica, Stephen, and I were just chatting beforehand, and it's kind of like we're saying, so what is polarization? And I think, you know, as a researcher, I'm going to put some stats on the table, and I'm going to put a particular view. But I'll tell you what I'm hoping for that we can have a discussion on, because this will help inform Stephen and Eric's work, my work, and the work broadly of Positive Energy, is what do we define as polarization, and how should we organize our research in terms of polarization? The other thing is a definition or a discussion about where polarization is taking place. Because the reality is that this particular issue, it's a very complex ecosystem. We could talk about polarization among elite audiences. We could talk about polarization among Canadians and the general populace. We could talk about polarization in the media, polarization between advocacy groups. So I'm hoping today, especially when we get to the panel that will be led by Mike, that we could get feedback on, when I think of polarization, this is what I think about, because a definition of polarization and how to measure polarization is fundamental to the work that Steve and Eric and I are doing, because it'll influence how we kind of cut and organize the data. And I'm hoping, and I'm just like to say, I'm ecumenical on this. My only bias is that for anyone that works with me on the math front, is that whenever we're doing modeling or math, I believe in the theory of parsimony. I'd call it elegance, right? The less complicated something is, that's kind of just, and that just happens to be my personal kind of empirical bias, that if we have a definition of polarization, that I would like it to be elegant, if at all possible. But what I'm going to do is unpack, and one of the big ideas or comments that I see coming out of this is that this is not, and this is from our research, and I, from the preliminary stuff that I saw from Stephen and Eric, it's not polarization everywhere on everything. We should be trying to unpack and put a spotlight on areas where polarization exists, and what are the potential dimensions of polarization. And one of the great parts of the work that Stephen and Eric did is that they had more flexibility in looking at to the partisan and ideological drivers of polarization. What my research suggests, and we didn't get into that area, so I'm not disagreeing with anything that they're saying, and I like not to disagree with Stephen because we're friends. But But what I'd like to put on the table is what our research does is put a spotlight on polarization related to the economic dimension. So you have to think of it in that particular terms, that when we talk about a lot of things, there's a general consensus or different levels of consensus, but that when we start to get on some specific issues, specifically when we start to talk about, are we willing to trade off jobs in the economy? Are we willing to, how is it, can we transition quickly to a non-carbon economy? What does that mean for the economy? When we start adding an economic dimension, that's where you see greater polarization in the numbers compared to a lot of other numbers. So maybe one parsimonious way to look at this is money, not money, and just look at that, just a straight kind of dimensional line that you would cut through the data. But one of the things that's interesting is that, you know, regardless of when we're doing the survey, that it's pretty clear that Canadians think that we're doing a pretty poor job on this. And, you know, you have to think of it this way. Canadians are not public policy experts. But you can see basically on any given day, less than one out of every five Canadians think that we're actually doing a good job on having environmental policies which align with the views of Canadians, balancing local community interests with that are affected by infrastructure, having a vision, building confidence in energy decision-making. The reality is the net score is the difference between the positive and the negative opinions. So I think, you know, one kind of, if I was to put a general opinion that is most likely to be shared by a majority of Canadians, is it's hard to find a lot of people that think that we're doing a very good job when it comes to the environment and the economy. And the other interesting thing when we look, especially from a directional perspective, and this is actually critical, considering the overlapping and intermingled responsibilities of provincial and federal governments on energy and the environment, how you can see on the tracking of opinion that the appetite for the national interest being more important than local interests has actually significantly increased over the last number of years. And perhaps this speaks to the perception that we are gridlocked and can't get anything done. That in our normal governance structure that relies on a heavy role, an important role for provinces, it's just not working the way the Federation should be working in terms of finding solutions. And as a result, what you can see compared to March 2015, a 13-point increase in the proportion of Canadians that believe that the national interests are more important than the views of local interests. And, you know, you get a similar number and a similar trend when it comes to Indigenous peoples compared to the national interest. The numbers have been stable over the last year, but compared to March 2015, there's been a noticeable increase in the proportion of Canadians that think that the national interest should be more important than the rights of First Nations, Métis, and Inuit people. And even on the provincial front, that same kind of trend line. And this is where, you know, Steve will have the benefit in a couple years of having slides like this where he can show the directional. You know, the advantage that I have today and the disadvantage for Steve is he's presenting a snapshot and he's building a benchmark for the future. The advantage that I have, at least, is we've got a few waves of research under our belt to see the direction that the numbers are moving in. But, you know, the key takeaway on all of this is that when you look at the net appetite for the national interest, I hate using the word Trump, but the national interest being more important than local, provincial, or Indigenous issues, that not only is it a majority opinion, but that the trend at this particular point in time suggests that the appetite for the national interest being a key driver of decisions, even over provincial, Indigenous, and local interests, is driving in a particular direction. Now, that said, the environment has a significant, as small e environment, has a significant impact on things. So something can change in the public place that could have a material impact on the direction. But what's clear, at least right now, is that it doesn't matter any way you cut it. It doesn't matter who you stack up the national interest in. The intensity is increasing, and the direction is in one particular direction. We can also see that people are more likely to support a more aggressive transition compared to 2018. And, you know, you can see here, then, when we ask about whether people think it is possible or not possible to develop energy resources while protecting the environment, still very strong opinions. And this goes back to, you know, if we talk about polarization. So my view, using our first cut at our definition of what would qualify as a polarizing or non-polarizing issue, would be if the score was zero, it would be perfect polarization, because there'd be just as many people with one view as having the opposing view. If it was 0 to plus 10 or minus 10, a net score, that would still be, in my opinion, today, and Steve will persuade me maybe otherwise, but today, that would be a polarized opinion. But that once we get past a 10 or 20 point differential in the numbers in one particular direction or another, that this is not really polarization. My view, at least today, would be that this is more a majority or minority opinion, or potentially a consensus opinion. But you can see the reality is massive net scores in one direction when it comes to this particular aspiration. And when we do a lot of our other research on the intersection between energy and the environment, usually people say stuff like, if we're doing focus groups, they'd say, like, don't we have the technology? Like, we can send someone to the moon, but we don't have the technology to try to reconcile or do a better job at reconciling energy and the environment. And it would be just a general default question that the average layperson would ask. And I think this is where kind of science, technology, the role of advanced technology, where we need to make strategic investments in the future, could actually be critical at perhaps giving people a little more confidence that someone is working on not just public policy solutions, but technological solutions, in order to try to square the circle on this. No big surprise, you can see growth of the renewable sector in terms of support. Pretty well a slam dunk, right? More than 9 out of every 10 Canadian supporters somewhat support. And what were even good scores back in 2015 are even better scores now. Taxes on fossil fuels. So this is support or opposition to having new taxes on fossil fuels if the tax was directed to projects related to a greener economy. You can see a little more division on this front compared to others, and more of a mixed bag. And I would hazard to say that this particular measure is very susceptible to what's in the news. That when the government of the day announces a carbon tax, and when the opposition or an opposition party or provincial premiers come out against a carbon tax, that it actually substantially and materially has an impact on how people feel about this. Growth of the oil and gas sector, you can see that there is right now, this would hit the criteria of Nick's polarization score, very close to it, because you can see it's only basically a plus 12 in terms of the net score, but that there's, you know, you can see visually that it's a pretty even distribution in terms of people supporting or opposing the growth in the oil and gas sector in Canada. Obviously, there are lots of regional variations to this. You know, the score is actually very different in the Prairie provinces. Compared to provinces like Quebec. But, you know, the reality is we would put this on the table as a polarization point, that when people think of the oil and gas sector and its future, that it is a fundamentally polarizing issue that people are putting a spotlight on right now. Its role, if it operates in an environmentally responsible way, you can see still the majority of Canadians agreeing or somewhat agreeing that it can play an important role if it becomes more environmentally responsible. But what we've seen is a bit of an increase of Canadians that say even if it was environmentally responsible, they would not be hot on the oil and gas sector, although we have to make note that this is still quite a minority opinion, with only one out of every five Canadians having that particular view. On the export front, and you know, it's interesting, there's been a lot of discussion related to exports from Canada's oil and gas sector contributing to combating global climate change if they displaced other energy sources that are more damaging to the economy. You can see, although the agreement with this statement is still relatively strong, there's been a little bit of a diminishment in intensity on this particular front. Should Canada go on its own? This has to do with, should we be reducing our oil and gas production, even if other oil and gas producing countries are not doing that? Actually, what the research suggests, at least over the past year, is that there's a bit of a greater appetite for us to go our own way, that we should not be waiting for other economies to scale back on oil and gas before we go forward on our own path. And I think this is another key finding that kind of speaks to what I'll call the moment in time that we're at in terms of people understanding the intersection between the energy and environmental aspirations, and then also realizing, you know what, we can't wait for the perfect time for everyone to catch up with where we want to be, that perhaps there's an increasing number of Canadians are saying, you know what, we might just have to start on our own path and to figure out how that journey will work out and not wait for everything else to come into line. So on the trade-offs, you can see, at least compared to 2018, there's increasing support, but opinion is quite divisive. And this goes back to what I'd said. You know, one of the clear things that we've come through in our research is that this dimension, once we start intersecting jobs, taxes, and so forth, it basically creates more of a polarized context for many of the views of Canadians. So you can see developing economic partnerships with Indigenous communities, even if it means energy prices rising, a bit of a mixed bag. Less economic development, you can see almost in our world, at least the way I measure, almost perfect polarization. And, you know, you can see at least here is that when we start looking at things like less economic development and to a lesser extent energy prices increasing, that the level of polarization significantly increases in the population. People generally are okay with tax revenues decreasing as a result of this, but you can see the whole issue of Canada getting less of its energy from domestic energy production, more from imports, that once you start getting into that area, you can see a lot of people disagree with the whole idea of us importing as opposed to kind of focusing more on our domestic situation. It's the same thing. So, sorry, that was a duplicate slide. That's what happens when you're doing your slides on Sunday without any staff around, because everyone's working on the election, and I can't quite tell people stop working on the election and do the positive energy stuff. So exactly. So it's all the more benefit for you, Monica, and your team that I was working on this myself, except that I have a duplicate slide. So testing on whether Canada should meet its climate commitments, even if it means tax revenues to governments decreasing. You can see there's support for that. Having more energy infrastructure related to windmills, solar farms, etc. People are on board with that. Energy prices increasing, a little more kind of division on that. Less economic development. You can see more polarization on that front. Also, when we look at getting on the domestic front, this is a different dimension, but you know, a bit more of a mixed bag. Reducing oil and gas, not a big surprise. not a lot of polarization, except when it comes to energy prices and less economic development. So this has to do with the statement, Canada should reduce oil and gas production. So yes, it's all good until we see that it might have an impact on economic development or energy prices, and then you have much more polarizing views on this. The other thing is that, when we look at the trend line at least, it is becoming much, this particular issue of reducing oil and gas production and its impact, knock-on impact on energy prices, is becoming marginally more, is polarizing before, but is becoming much more polarizing right now. On the economic front, that was less polarizing last year than it is right now. I think the reality is that when we're looking at the Gen Pop stuff, as soon as you start to introduce trade-offs that are more economic, you start moving into the area of polarization. And maybe the key takeaway here is if we can have a process with a greater role for the national government to provide a more coherent strategy and to figure out a journey, that would probably be the first step in people being a little more open to things. I'm going to do a quick walk through the, and this is only three slides, the opinion leaders, which I said was closed out on Friday. And we, the opinion leaders, the panels includes regulators, elected officials, First Nations stakeholders, NGOs, and the media. And they're asked to do a survey, basically. In this particular round, we focused a lot on a battery of questions and asked individuals in the panel to talk about each of these statements. And what I've done is I've done three broad groupings, and you can see the net scores. I'm not presenting all the detailed data because that'll be in the report, but the net scores gives you an idea of the highest intensity of consensus. And you can see the statement that scored at the very top, we need a long-term strategy, even if some provinces don't agree with it. That being kind of one of the key things. I'm not going to walk through all of these, but what this speaks to is that whether it's a high-intensity negative or positive score, there's consensus opinion, at least among opinion leaders, on many of these issues, which is interesting considering the diversity of individuals that are responding to the survey. But what this all points to is that for opinion leaders is that they, almost more than anyone else, know that we need action on this and that the current system is not working. You can see that opinion leaders don't believe that we're doing our fair share at addressing climate change. They don't believe that provinces should be able to address climate change in whatever way they want, they see fit. They don't believe that local communities should have a final say when deciding on whether an infrastructure project related to energy goes forward or not. And I think what's clear is that among these elite audiences, they know that there's a significant level of dysfunction. Stuff just can't get done, and we don't have a process for getting it done. No one's taking responsibility, and that there's no leadership. And the result is a fundamental structural problem that we have when we're talking about this. This is kind of like the third tier, the statements that had the least level of consensus. And you can see at the bottom, if we adopt Nick's criteria or look use Nick's lens at what is a polarizing view or not, there was really only one dimension that was polarizing in the elite audience, and that had to do with the statement, phasing out oil and gas production and consumption is unnecessary because new technologies will dramatically reduce emissions from oil and gas. So this has to do with the future of oil and gas and what is reasonable in terms of what could possibly be achieved. So what I found quite interesting is that for the Gen Pop, at least, this is my yellow slide. I told Monica, I said, when you see the yellow side, that's like my amber alert that I'm on my last slide. So the key takeaways from my research that we've done on your behalf is that there's a significantly growing consensus that we need national leadership, and that's why this election should be considered so disappointing. because they're expecting all national leaders and our national leadership to engage on this and to talk about where the future needs to be taken, but that there's a consensus that in the general public that we need more national leadership, and that it looks like there's appetite for national leadership to judge what's in the national interest compared to what could be, I'll call it, veto for local communities, a veto for provinces, a veto for indigenous populations. And that, and when we think of polarization in the general public, it's fundamentally driven by economic and job implications. That when we step outside of that, there's a consensus that there's a problem, there's a consensus on who should lead, there's a consensus on where we want to be, and then it's more of a mixed bag into how much will this affect jobs, how much will this affect economic development, either positively or negative, and how much might this affect taxes. And the other thing is that at least our initial cut at the elite audiences, and this is my last point before I open it up to questions, is I thought there was actually strong consensus. What does this mean? I don't like using the word smart people, but people who are in this area generally agree on most things, that there's a fundamental problem and that there needs to be a new paradigm for reconciling our national interests with a sensitivity to local concerns, indigenous rights, and also provincial rights. But that one of the things that is a bit of a polarizing has to do with the sector itself and the future of the sector and how aggressively that future might or might not change. So with that, I think that's it for me. So I'm going to pass it over to Monica.
You got to stick around and answer some questions.
Yeah, yes.
Great. Thanks very much, Nick. And I believe we have a microphone that's available for if anyone wants to ask questions. We are recording these sessions, so if we could please use the microphone, that would be useful for those who will watch it subsequent. Maybe while people kind of get their thoughts together around questions, I'll just ask, well, I don't know if it's a question or a comment, Nick, but you know, on the one hand, one could say, okay, that's interesting and perhaps positive that there's growing consensus in the general public on the need for national leadership. I think the question that I have is, but does everybody agree on what national leadership would look like?
Yeah. Well, that's not that I don't have an answer for that from a survey perspective. But my general comment is that for a lot of these questions, people project their view on what national leadership is when they hear national leadership. So for some people, it might be a heavy hand. And for other people, it might be a light hand. But this could be something that we could follow up on. But unpacking what national leadership realistically means and how it intersects with indigenous rights, provincial rights, and also the sensitivities of local communities, I think would be a good thing to try to unpack.
Yeah, and my recollection from some of the results that Stephen is going to present in the next panel is that he'll help us to see just how complicated that is likely to be. So we have somebody here with a microphone. Maybe if you have a question, make it very obvious. Put your hand up nice and high so she can see. Alicia, do we have somebody? Okay, great.
Hi, I'm Normand Mousseau. The first point, when you look at the data, you see there's a big jump in the people who think a national intervention is needed after the election of Trudeau. So under Harper, somehow, it was much lower, and then it's mostly flat. So is it mostly seen as a projection of seeing, no, there's people at the national level who want to move, so we should have something there? Or is it really a transformation which is deeper?
Okay, so I'd like, not to sound like an academic, I'd like more data to see whether this is a one-off or not. But what we do know is that regardless of whether a prime minister is popular or not, when a prime minister puts something on the agenda, average Canadians, believe it or not, take it at face value as something that's important. And I think that's why, you know, to my comment on how the environment is moving up, a lot of that could just be because we have a Liberal government right now that has decided to put it on the agenda. In the same way that under Stephen Harper, back to Monica's point on what is national leadership, Stephen Harper's view on national leadership on energy and environmental files was very different than Justin Trudeau's. So this particular measure, although we've seen a step up over the last number of years, if we had a different government, and why don't we just do fantasy politics for a second? Let's say Andrew Scheer wins the election. If he advances a different view of national leadership, We'll see whether it actually has an impact and whether this is a structural change or whether this is short term. So I'm not disagreeing with your hypothesis, but what I'm saying is I'd like to have a few more data points so that we can see, okay, we have a prime minister that has a different view on national leadership, and now the numbers are kind of dialing back in a different direction.
Great. Go ahead, Alicia, and then I know we've got quite a few questions over here if you want
to. I'll be quick. Kelly Bronson, I'm here at University of Ottawa. I'm a Canada Research Chair in Science and Society. Back to your original question about what constitutes polarization. To me, at least, you know, I guess I have a secondary question, which is what distinguishes polarization from healthy deliberation or debate Correct. In a democracy? And for me, ideology or the sort of ideologically driven nature of division is an important aspect. And I wondered if any of your survey instrumentation captured the evidence upon which people are forming these opinions.
No, but I think ours did not. But Stevens and Eric's work focuses more on the ideological front and puts more of a spotlight on that. The only thing that I can say, I like the idea on, well, is polarization good, right? Is that a natural part of public discourse? And my answer is I don't know whether it's good, but I think just from a straight research point of view, if we think from a governance and output point of view, if we do not have majority opinions on things, then it just makes life a lot more difficult from a public policy. And when I say majority opinions, I don't mean everyone. I'm talking about if 60% of Canadians are on the page on one thing and 40% oppose, then at least there's a majority opinion for public policymakers. But if it's 50-50, I think that's when you kind of get into a trickier space for politicians who are trying to navigate in this space and governments that are trying to reconcile views that might be very difficult to reconcile.
And just a couple of just quick comments on that, and I think Stephen will probably speak to it as well. Certainly from the perspective of the second survey, part of what you're looking for in terms of polarization research is changes over time and kind of an evacuation of the middle, right? And you're not looking for that because you want to see it, but if you are seeing that, that certainly suggests that you've got growing polarization. The other thing I would just note is thank you for your comment about what evidence are people making their developing their views on energy. So somewhere, if we could, Positive Energy team, write that down, because this is a living survey, so we will be able to make changes over time. And I don't recall that we asked that question, but I think it's an excellent question to ask. So over to this direction.
Nick, Dave Collier. Just a couple of questions, maybe a two-part question. The first is it struck me again, looking at your polling, we tend to look at these issues in silos. Mm-hmm. And my view is that this is part of the challenge in this, is it's a very complex, multidimensional problem, and it's the connectivity between environment, energy, economy that is really the issue. And that's where it gets tough, and tough to pick up those sort of dimensions in your polling. So I'd like your perspective on that. Second part of the question is around leadership. And leadership actually requires making choices and making hard decisions. We can't have it all. And I think when I look at the political environment we're in, nobody actually wants to confront that and have the honest conversation about the issues that are facing us. So how do we get over that hurdle?
So in terms of your first question on the complexity and connectivity of issues, I think the good piece of news is that Canadians now, when they think of the environment, are at least thinking of it as more of a complex issue as opposed to a black and white issue. Now, are they ready to talk about that? I don't think so. But the first step is it's kind of like, Alcoholics Anonymous. The first step is to recognize that this is complex. Can you recognize that this is complex? That's the first step to healing and finding a solution. So perhaps one way to look at it is that Canadians are at the very first step, but it's a 10-step process. In terms of choices, you know, the one thing that is absent from this and I think our politicians are, you know, and I know I'm being recorded, but I know our politicians are largely to blame for this, is that they've really failed to tell people what the sacrifices are for what they want to achieve. And I think politicians should just be straight up. And I would also hazard to say that if a politician stood up and told the truth to say, if you want to achieve this, there are certain sacrifices that we're going to need to make in the next 5 or 10 years. Are you willing to make that sacrifice for the benefit of future generations? And not to sugarcoat it, and not to say that we can have everything, and not to say that it's, not to say that everything will be fine. I think Canadians are willing for that, but I don't think they've heard any politician tell the truth about, okay, you know, it's kind of like, you know, you do polling on taxes, and you want taxes to go down, and everybody says, of course I want my taxes to go down. And then we'd say, well, what are you going to do about healthcare? How's that going to be funded? And then as soon as you start to introduce trade-offs, which is one of the things that Monica and her team have been introducing in our research and also in the research for Stephen, is the whole idea of trade-offs. And what we need is for politicians to start honestly talking about trade-offs. So that, and you know what? Then Canadians can decide for themselves whether they want those trade-offs or not. Maybe they don't want those trade-offs. Maybe there are other trade-offs that they're willing to exist, they're willing to take, but to say, hey, there are trade-offs. This is not a perfect world. And then we want to find out and uncover what trade-offs Canadians are willing to accept and which trade-offs they're not willing to accept in order to try to get to the place that they want to get to.
I think we have time for one more question, then we need to move into the panel. Please.
Okay. Hi, I'm Chad Park with the Energy Futures Lab. Thanks, Nick, for your data there and presentation. One question I have is, you alluded to it in comment in one particular point, but it's about regional differences.
Yep.
And so I gather that the regional differences didn't show up in the research, but I'm wondering if it could in future versions, and or if you have any reflections on how that affects the outcomes.
Yeah, thanks, Chad, for putting a spotlight on that. Actually, the report has all the regional differences, but we only have 25 minutes to go over. There are regional differences. So, yeah. How's that? And it'll be all in the report, including there are demographic differences, there are gender differences. So it's all there.
Great. Thank you very much, Nick. I think this gives us a really good basis upon which to move forward. I'd like to invite everyone to join me in...
You have been listening to the Positive Energy Podcast. Today's episode was produced by myself, Ian T.D. Thompson, with audio provided from ISSP U Ottawa's YouTube channel, which is linked in the description. For more information on the Nano's opinion surveys, as well as the fall conference, please visit the Positive Energy website.